Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
Also by mystery writer Dan Andriacco. His upcoming novel, Rogues Gallery, is the latest in the Sebastian McCabe, Jeff Cody series. Learn more on Dan's blog, Baker Street Beat, at danandriacco.com.
And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 78, Legal and Leisure Ramblings.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Hi, and welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Walder.
Ha, and we unite forces like the Wonder Twins to welcome you to another discussion of what's going on in the world of Sherlock Holmes today. What is going on, Burt?
Everything is going on. We have fabulous new sponsors, including Dan Andriacco.
Yes.
And you can learn more about him, as we just mentioned, at his blog, which is danandriacco.com.
Yeah.
DanAndriacco.
That is fantastic. Dan is a great Sherlockian. We'll talk a little bit more about his offerings later in the show.
Yes.
But
yes.
Saw him at the very least, I think, a year ago. As we are recording now on, what is it, June 13th,
today.
is Scintillation of Scions 8, I believe. And I met him maybe it's 7.
Mm, I hope.
Those Roman numerals really messed me up. Once you get past V, you know, it's all downhill for me.
I hope it's not 8. That would mean I missed all 8. I just prefer to miss the first 7.
There you go. Yeah, wait for the 8th cab.
That's right.
But Jacqueline Morris does a phenomenal job putting on a nice little conference down there in the greater Baltimore area called Scintillation of Scions, and it's now in its 8th year, we suppose. And that's where I saw Dan last year, outfitted in his typical bow tie and hawking his books, and he's got even more to hawk now, so...
His hawk-like visage.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, but if you'd like to get in touch with us, and many people have, we encourage you to go to ihearofsherlock.com.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can find us on the interwebs.
It's still going, is it, the internet?
Yeah, all those social networks. We are I Hear of Sherlock at any of those. So Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, just plug in I Hear of Sherlock to their address schemas, and you will find us on each one of those.
Well, if only we were on Flipboard. You know, Flip, that would be good. We should think about that.
Well, you know, if you go to ihose.co/flipsherlock.
You're kidding.
There's our Flipboard magazine. Yeah.
What about Scoop It?
Well, funny you should ask.
You're kidding.
ihose.co/scoopsherlock.
We must be everywhere.
So anything you want to do to Sherlock,
yeah.
You want to flip him, you want to scoop him.
Scoop him.
And whatever other trendy sites there are out there. You can do that to Sherlock with iHose.
Probably no reason for people not to leave us a review either. What about iTunes? They must be able to do that.
Funny you should say that. Yeah, if you go to bit.ly/ I Hear of Sherlock, that'll get you to iTunes, and that's where you can leave us a 4-star review.
Yep.
Wait, is that the highest or is it 5?
I don't know.
Whatever the highest is, go one more than that and we'll take it.
Yes.
Free of charge.
Free of charge. And for the people who leave us the best reviews, we're very proud to announce the new I Hear of Sherlock tag sale. We have a very special collection of tags from Victorian England. Yes, they say 2 and 6, £2.10, tuppence, threepence on them. Absolutely rare. They'll be coming in the mail to you who give us positive reviews.
I have those as part of the IHOs great big grab bag of gifts, or the IHOs GBGBs.
Yeah.
You don't want a case of the IHOs GBGBs, let me tell you.
No, I had that once, yeah. And I had to sit down for most of a weekend.
Well, strangely, where I got it, I couldn't sit down.
Oh! That was much luckier.
You never know.
You never know.
But if you want to call us, too, we have a call-in line. And we will play some audio comments from some of our listeners last time, because we put out an audio challenge for people to call us at 774-221-READ. Or if you don't feel like spelling on your phone, because I've never been able to spell with numbers. I've been able to color by number, but not spell by numbers. So that's 774-221-7323.
Right. Or 323-7122-477 backwards.
That's true. Hmm. Now I have to reverse tape. What did we leave out? Email.
Email. Just send us an email for all the good it'll do you.
Yes. Comment. Comment at ihearofsherlock.com.
That's right.
And we will ignore that along with all the other things, too.
We will. So, and this week, we're brought to you by Municipal Parking Deck 109 in Canton, Michigan. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
If you can find us. Well, a lot's been going on in the news lately, and I know there's a big, big topic, but before we get to that, why don't we cover some of the more lighthearted things in the news?
Oh, lighthearted. Like, for example, what?
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
Well, at the end of there are a few lighthearted things. At the end of May, we missed the San Francisco Silent Film Festival.
But you know, I was in the neighborhood and I was listening for it, and I could not. I was so close, and I just couldn't hear anything.
They're using silencers now. Ear to the ground, my friend. But you got to watch out for those cable cars if you do that.
Ow!
But we did send an emissary. We sent Tim Greer to check it out and be an correspondent for us. Mm-hmm. And he wrote up a really nice review and included some photos there as well. So we'll have a link in the show notes to our review of William Gillette stepping onto the screen in front of hundreds of Sherlockians for the very first time.
Mm.
But by all accounts, it was absolutely amazing. The cheers that went up when he stepped out, and the humor that was written into the movie, and just the melodrama. I think Tim said that when he made his first appearance, when Gillette made his first appearance wearing the dressing gown, the crowd went wild.
Mm.
And he said it's the first time he's seen a standing ovation for a dressing gown in his life.
And its inhabitant.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. That was something. But I guess the film is making its way around the country. Other stops include Seattle, Washington, D.C., Chicago.
It's in New York, actually, tomorrow and Tuesday. I was supposed to go tomorrow morning, and I have a client meeting. So I'm deeply, deeply – not only do I miss it on the West Coast, I'm missing it on the East Coast. But
well,
let's see. Sure.
The good news is you can get the DVD Blu-ray.
Yes, yes.
Which is available for pre-order. If you go to ihos.co/1916Blu-ray, you can...
Shall the examination proceed? Yes, let it proceed by all means.
I think it's a little early for that.
Just a little early for that.
Don't quiz me on that. No, if you go to ihos.co/1916Blu-ray.
That's pretty cheap, 1916. That's an odd number, too.
You can pre-order. I think it was going for $29.95, maybe.
Cheap at twice the price.
Yeah, yeah. But
how much is that in euros, one wonders?
It's,
what if I want the unrestored version? Can I get the unrestored version?
Yeah,
in French francs.
All you have to do is pop in the Blu-ray to your player and then run a Brillo pad across your HD television screen. And there you'll have it.
Or pop into my TARDIS and go back to 1916 and pick it up myself.
Oh. So that's the Silent Film Festival. We also did a little bit of celebrating recently on iHearOfSherlock.com.
1,000 posts.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
Yeah. We've been in business nearly 10 years as a website, and we finally hit 1,000 posts.
Hmm.
And the pace is picking up. We've had a lot of great contributions from our friends, people like Tim Greer.
Great people.
Yeah. And Chris Redmond and Derek Belanger, and of course our stalwart standby Gordon Demowski, who has written the most guest post for us. So it's a great team of people. We've got some upcoming stuff from some contributors as well that we'll talk about in just a little bit.
Yeah,
but it's worth celebrating, and it's worth. Just pausing for a moment and considering that, we were on the cutting edge of where the internet was going 10 years ago.
Thanks to you.
Well, thanks to the whole movement, really. I mean, it's been amazing to just see people continually interested and frankly, we've also had lots of supporters that continue to come, out of the woodwork since, our last show, we had contributors like Joseph Vega and William Simpson, Peter Lawrence, and once again, James O'Leary and Mary Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also joined by Bob Byrne. So folks that are contributing to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere via PayPal and helping to support the cause from a financial perspective, we really do appreciate that. Again, those funds help to defray the costs of, registering websites and paying for bandwidth and paying for distribution.
People have no idea what an internet operation really costs, particularly one devoted to a 19th century figure like Sherlock Holmes. You may think it's easy to buy whale oil for these lamps, but let me tell you, folks, it goes at a very high price.
Yeah, and until my children were old enough, I had to hire people to shovel coal into that steam-driven machine that was keeping the internets going from our perspective. So, but in classic Victorian tune, I do use child labor now, so...
Excellent.
That at least has worn down a little bit, but the whale oil, that's the commodities have just gone off the charts lately.
They have. It keeps them fit too. The youngins appreciate it.
They need it. They really do.
Yeah.
But so anyway, it's thanks to you, our listeners and our readers of the site that help keep it going. So we thought it was a great time to just pause and.
Yeah.
Appreciate the audience as well as take a look back at some of the great things that we've shared over those years.
And always remember the overriding advantage of reading things online. Friends, you do not need to lick your finger to turn the page.
You can even lick someone else's finger and it won't matter.
You can, but it's more sanitary, it's safe and convenient.
True, true. Especially in the confines of your own home.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we talk about the big news?
The big news?
Do you know what it is?
And that is, you mean freeing Mr. Holmes?
Free Mr. Holmes. Hashtag free Mr. Holmes. Yeah.
It's the right price.
It seems like we just got done freeing Sherlock, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It does.
Yeah. Once again, our friends at the Conan Doyle Estate Limited And
we should have a sound effect for that, you know?
Is that the one?
No, here it is.
Don't make me destroy you. If you only knew the power of the dark side.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Wow. Sounds like someone needs an oxygen tank or something there, right?
Yeah, something, yeah.
Well, yeah, a lot of people have viewed it something like that. You know, once again, the Conan Doyle estate has swept in, trying to disrupt the distribution of the new film Mr. Holmes, which is being distributed by
Miramax,
Roadside Entertainment, and Miramax. So I'm sure Harvey Weinstein's getting a real rise out of this. But the basic premise is that by the way, Random House and Mitch Cullen, the author of A Slight Trick of the Mind, are also part of this lawsuit or part of this cease and desist, because the notion is that Holmes in retirement is something that belongs in the last 10 stories.
Yeah.
Which it does and it doesn't. You know, there are mentions of Sherlock Holmes's retirement in some of the earlier stories, but evidently it's the Sussex, you know, the chalk cliffs, the Sussex Downs, et cetera, that are at odds. And I guess there was one paragraph or so quoted from the book about how Holmes positioned himself with his back to the window so he could read the face of the client. It seemed a little too close for comfort in that case, but you know, Lady Trelawney Hope positions herself with her back to the window so Holmes couldn't read her facial features, and he commented on it in The Second Stain, which was much earlier on in the canon. So,
well, I think the estate locked her up for 3 to 5, didn't they?
After that move, they could have.
Yeah.
Or they should have. Yeah. But it just looks like the estate will stop at nothing to try and squeeze some last dollars out of the Hollywood machine and popular culture to try and get what it thinks is its due in these last waning years of U.S. copyright.
Well, you know, it's also in a way, you know, very reflective of the legal system and particularly the American legal system. If you have a set of intellectual property assets, and in your view, a large enterprise has availed themselves of those assets without paying you anything. You know, I mean, I have absolutely no inside knowledge or any knowledge at all about this other than what I read. But it's not unreasonable for you to say, you know, why don't I instigate a little action here if I can do it at relatively little cost, and 100% of whatever I get out of it is going to be a lot better than what I have, which is 100% of nothing.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, a lot of folks operate like that. So there's also that way of thinking about it.
Which, you know, it's you wonder what Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would think of it. This is a guy who, first of all, we already saw this from the Free Sherlock movement. It was quoted what he told William Gillette. You know, you may marry him, murder him, do whatever you like with him. He was pretty free-handed when it came to that. Now, one may argue that the times changed and his view on Holmes changed, but this is a guy who was about chivalry and gentlemanliness, whose epitaph on his gravestone says, "Steel true, blade straight." Mm. And if taken today, based on what his estate is doing, it might be steel rusted, blade crooked. Who knows?
Well, I happened to post earlier today something that I observe on the Sherlock Holmes Google Plus cite something that I observed that reports that Conan Doyle apparently has taken action from beyond the grave. He's apparently sued his own estate via a Ouija board. And that newspaper article was up on the Google Plus Sherlock Holmes group page. With the description of what happened and exactly how that lawsuit came to be, but we gotta
make that a blog post on the main site. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's up there. Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, has sued the Conan Doyle estate, according to a lawsuit filed yesterday in Tweehawken, Pennsylvania. Carl Planchett, owner of Planchett's Paranormal Parlor, says a Ouija board manufactured in 1890 had been vibrating mysteriously. And you've got the whole story there.
That's fantastic.
The complaint points to statements harming the reputation of Arthur Conan Doyle as an individual deceased person and subjecting the character of Sherlock Holmes to groundless criticism. He also wanted to know why no one is interested in Sir Nigel, whoever that is.
The same reason they never were. Wow.
Yeah. So I'll be interested to see how that case proceeds.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things where they're certainly not going to hold off the release of the movie because of this little lawsuit. I mean, if anything, it would seem that the lawsuit would do better to wait for the performance of the film and then try and go after a cut of the profits. Or the revenues after, but this is one of those things where it's just annoying enough that rather than go to court, Miramax may very well just throw some money at it and tell them to go away. And frankly, that's the exact business model of the Conan Doyle estate. So
yeah, 100% of something is better than 100%
of. But we did get a statement from our good friend Les Klinger, who brought the case against the Conan Doyle estate under the Free Sherlock movement. Because we asked him if he had any sense as to what was going to happen. And here's what he said. Miramax will be making a business decision regarding this case after advice from counsel. I'm sure that counsel will advise them that, A, the CDEL's copyright infringement claims are very weak, because the script, which I've read, uses virtually no materials from any story that remains in copyright, and such use in any event likely constitutes fair use. And B, the trademark infringement claims are even weaker because the CDEL has not registered any trademarks in the relevant class. Applications don't have any legal significance. However, that does not mean that Miramax will decide to proceed without a license. I would expect that, as in the past, the CDEL's demands regarding a license fee will be proportionally very small relative to the overall Miramax budget for production and marketing of the film. And furthermore, the license fee is likely to be far less than the anticipated legal fees that Miramax would expend in defense of its position. As to the balance of the claims against Penguin Random House and Mitch Cullen regarding the book A Slight Trick of the Mind, I do not see any reason why the statute of limitations respecting copyright infringement should not bar such claims, regardless of the merits of the action. These comments are based solely on my review of the complaint and the script and represent my personal views only. I have not been engaged in any capacity with regard to the case. From Les Klinger.
Oh, very good.
He sounds like a lawyer. So, you know, the case will continue to play out, and we will continue to follow it on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. We did reach out to Mitch Cullen and asked him if he would be on the show, not only in the lead up to the film, but to maybe talk about this. And as you can imagine, on advice of counsel, he declined an interview at this time. But expect to hear from Mitch Cullen in the future about A Slight Trick of the Mind and Mr. Holmes.
Yeah, been good to talk to him.
Yeah. Now, have you seen the trailer, the previews for Mr. Holmes at all?
I haven't seen the recent ones. I saw the early ones.
Yeah. They look quite good. I mean, the cinematography itself looks excellent.
No, it's Ian McKellen. You know, I'd watch Ian McKellen read a phone book.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it turns out. I'm looking forward to it. I've heard from some people that said it actually improves upon the book.
Have you read the book?
I have read the book. I actually just recently read it. I had bought it when it first came out 10 years ago and put it in my, you know, pile of Sherlockian books to read, and it never got around to it. And now with the movie coming out, I wanted to be a little bit educated on it, and it was a really interesting story. You could see how Cullen actually borrowed heavily from the William S. Baring Gould biography of Sherlock Holmes. You know, the supposition that he lived into...
Well, there goes the Baring Gould estate now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that actually got me to thinking. You know, when Baring Gould wrote the biography in 1962...
Uh-oh, yeah.
He used, you know, Holmes in retirement, Holmes keeping bees, you know, the usual stuff in the non-out of copyright stories.
Yeah.
Why didn't the Conan Doyle estate sue him?
Well, actually, there was a story today, you know, and it really is very Victorian, very Robert Louis Stevenson, very Gothic. Apparently, his corpse has been dug up and he's been served with papers by the estate. They pried the lid open and stuffed the subpoena in there, apparently.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Well, if only the judge can hit them with the book, and we hope that book is the one volume annotated Sherlock Holmes. But you can tell that Cullen got a lot of his inspiration from the Baring Gould biography. You know, Watson passing away in 1929, Holmes living into the mid 20th century, Mycroft making it to the mid 1940s. Those elements were all part of the book.
So. But very few people have written about Mycroft's later career as a marathon runner.
Where he went under the name Jim Fix.
Yeah.
That was the marathon runner and writer. He wrote about exercise and fitness, and he actually died while running.
Yes, I remember. What a story that was.
That right there is the definition of irony.
Yeah.
So we'll continue to watch that. And watch this space over the next couple of days or so. We have a review, an early review of Mr. Holmes, because the screening in London happened just last week. And we sent one of our London correspondents over there, a brand new correspondent, Crystal Knoll, who is the founder and head runner of 221 Beacon. Crystal volunteered to go to the screening and the press conference with Laura Linney and Sir Ian McKellen, and came back with a fantastic review of the movie. So expect to see that on IHearOfSherlockEverywhere.com very soon.
Very good.
It's going to be the summer of Mr. Holmes.
Mm.
Summer me, winter me. You know, as much as we're kind of waxing poetic here about all of the stuff to see and do, the winter me says, well, we need to pay for that in some way.
Mm.
And that's our sponsors.
Oh, that's true.
They help us pay for that. Yeah.
They do. You know, I have to check my mailbox. I don't think I've gotten a check from them in a long while.
check in the garbage can. On the third of the month, there will be a brown paper bag laying on top.
Yeah. A photograph of a 15-pound note, and if we do right, there's more photographs where that came from.
Ah, yeah. So who do we have for sponsors?
Well, we've got the fabulous, the one, the only, the Wessex Press.
Love those guys.
Yeah. And they've been pressing ink and pressing into paper. They have, now here's something interesting. I haven't even had a chance to mention this to you. I had lunch with Matt Laffey, and among other things, we talked about the new series that he and Matthias Bostrom have been working on. Volume one, of course, is out and available now, Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the newspapers. It's just a wonderful example of how technology can help enthusiasts like us, because with the digitization of newspapers and periodicals, it's become possible now to, you know, relatively easily compile, list, and now publish information from the newspapers 1881 and through 1892 about Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. And this is part of a series that hopefully will continue in, up until Conan Doyle's passing in 1930, which means that there will be many more volumes of fascinating reading ahead. But you can buy... You don't need to go and get your printer and buy reams of paper and Google search all this stuff and OCR it and print it out online and print it out at home and put it in three-ring binders. No. No, that's all been done for you. You can buy an actual bound book copy of this for only $32.95 at WessexPress.com.
There you go. And get on it before Volume 2 comes out. I would imagine Matt and Matthias are hard at work on the second volume right now, right?
Yeah.
Great.
That's a great, really is a great book.
Yeah. Well, and so check that out at WessexPress.com.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new sponsor for episode 78. That is Dan Andriacco. Dan is, as we mentioned, a Sherlockian, a regular at some of the conferences and gatherings. He's a mystery writer who is the author of 9 books in genre, all of which have a Sherlock Holmes connection. The ongoing series features Sebastian McCabe and Jeff Cody, and it starts with No Police Like Holmes, and features a Holmes aficionado as an amateur sleuth. But his latest book in that series is Rogue's Gallery, and screenwriter and Sherlockian Bonnie McBird, who was also at Scintillation last year, by the way, commented about it, saying, "You're in the hands of a master of mystery plotting here. Rogue's Gallery is a delightful read, hard to put down, and highly recommended." So check Dan and his work out, which we're going to be doing another review fairly soon of his Kieran McCullen, Enoch Hale trilogy. He's co-author with Kieran McCullen of 3 novellas set in 1920s London. And the latest one is The Egyptian Curse. We've got a review coming up from Katie Magnuson, who was kind enough to get a review copy and write about that. So check it all out at danandriacco.com. That's where you can find his blog, Baker Street Beat, and links to all of his books. And we thank Dan for his new support. And I guess that leaves the old war horse, the Baker Street Journal.
Oh, are they still in business? I thought after 1946, surely everything since 1946 has been written about Sherlock Holmes already. The next issue must be blank, no?
Oh, far from it. It is chock full.
You're kidding. More?
Can you believe it?
I don't believe it.
Cartoons, reviews, events.
Word searches, Sudoku?
All of that, yeah. Color by number. No, it's scholarship. It is fun stuff, but it's also people that still have the bug to go everywhere, see everything, and figure out everything regarding Sherlock Holmes. And one of the latest items from the Baker Street Journal is none other than the exhibition catalog from the Sherlock Holmes exhibition from the Museum of London. Mm-hmm. It was a really great book put together by – it was compiled by Nicholas Utekin and Catherine Cook, some of the greats from the Sherlock Holmes Society of London and the BSI, of course. But you get a foreword from the exhibition's curator – and a wonderful illustrated record of the exhibition. So if you weren't able to make it over to London, to the Museum of London, to see this unprecedented exhibition, this is the next best thing. So get on over to BakerStreetJournal.com and check it out. It's only $20. So great bargain.
Friends, healthcare today costs too much and is just too complicated. With HMOs, EMOs, and EIEIOs, and deductibles and out-of-pockets that always come out of your pocket. That's why you need Sherlock Holmes brand health insurance, bringing the best of 19th century care to the 21st century. You'll receive a weekly bottle of brandy, smelling salts for your neurasthenia, a prudent ration of morphine, and best of all, you get to live with a doctor. Long walks in the country and sleeping with the windows open will help you feel better fast. Sign up for Sherlock Holmes brand health insurance today.
No word of whether there were 19th century amputations included at no cost.
A little giant do-it-yourself amputation kit. Oh, dear.
Wow. Well, we're talking about, I guess the title of the show is Legal and Leisure Ramblings. Mm. So we talked about the legal. Would love to hear about the leisure ramblings. Take us with you on your ramblings in the country.
Well, it was a great day. It was May 3rd, 2015, when Bob Katz and I drove out to Long Island from New Jersey. The first thing I thought of was George M. Cohan. For those who don't know, Cohan was a great star of the New York stage. In 1906, he had a big hit with this song. It marveled at how rural and rustic the country was, just a 45-minute train ride from Broadway. It's likely that Christopher Morley had the same feeling when he bought the house he dubbed Green Escape in Roslyn, Long Island in 1920. Then it also took about 45 minutes to get there from Midtown Manhattan, and it was in his old neighborhood of Roslyn that we gathered to mark Morley's 125th birthday a little ahead of time on May 3rd. Terry Hunt described our group.
This is the Grillparzer Club of the Hoboken Free State, which is named after two of Morley's creations, and it was organized by my wife Linda and me to commemorate Christopher Morley and specifically to meet at least once a year to celebrate his birthday. And this would be the mark his 125th birthday today. And we meet in various places of significance to Morley. So we have met in Manhattan and Hoboken. This is our third meeting, and I expect in the future that we'll be in Philadelphia at some point, in Baltimore, and we have hopes of traveling to Oxford, where Morley was a Rhodes Scholar.
The group first met a year ago in Manhattan at a restaurant that was in Morley's old working district, but this year's location had a direct connection to the old Mandarin.
We are at the Bryant Library in Roslyn, Long Island, which was the home of Christopher Morley, and he lived in Roslyn Estates, and he and his wife were active members of the library here and were on the board for a number of years. This was the community center, and it had a theater, and he produced a number of shows here, including Trojan Horse, and there's a great photo in the local history collection of some of the actors in that production dressed in Greek outfits, relaxing between rehearsal in the bowling alley in the basement. This was in the 40s. This was after World War II. Now, another connection, a significant one that Morley has with the library, is that the local history collection here has a fine Morley collection, books and manuscripts, and that's available to the public. They value Morley, and as well, of course, as William Cullen Bryant, for whom the library is named. And they were very, very happy to have us meeting here today.
There was a good turnout this year, including Ray Betzner, Steve Rothman, and Greg Ruby, all from Pennsylvania. Steve, who is probably the world authority on Morley's life and work, brought a few things from his collection.
I brought a crayon drawing of a railroad train going around a mountain that he did as a little boy, And it looks like every other little boy's drawing of a train, except that it's, of course, a steam engine, because when he was a little boy. But it's amusing, and it's amusing that it survived. I'm sure he gave it to someone who then gave it to Herman Abramson, from whose collection I bought it. And I brought a picture of the knothole when it was on the property of Green Escape in October 1938. It's inscribed on the back by Christopher Morley, "The Knothole, October 1938," and it shows how it was, and it still has the front porch and not the Dymaxion bathroom yet. And I brought a program for the Trojan Horse, which was produced at the Mill Pond Playhouse, which is the building that we're in now. The Trojan Horse was based on Morley's earlier book, The Trojan Horse, which is really a very interesting book in that he uses the story of the Iliad to show the war footing in 1930s. Then we also have a little piece of promotion for the production of The Trojan Horse. It's a little letterhead from the Mill Pond Playhouse, signed by the producer, David Lowe. And across it, Morley has written in pencil, "Dear Tat," who is Tatnall Brown, a friend of his, "here's full dope for the news or the prexy or whatever," because Tat Brown was then a dean at Haverford College. So the play was well received. There was an article with pictures about it and the cast and rehearsal in Life magazine at the time. I think it ran for quite a while and was really a decent deal.
Earlier in the day, we had visited the Knothole, Morley's writing cabin from 1934, which is now at Christopher Morley County Park. We visited the graves of Christopher and Helen Morley in a small, quiet cemetery, and we drank a toast there in his honor. It was an old mint julep recipe provided by Terry and Linda Hunt, but one of the very special features of the day was the chance to meet and talk with two of Christopher Morley's grandchildren.
I'm John Christopher Woodruff, Jock Woodruff, and I'm Christopher Morley's grandson, and I'm joined by
Janet Fairchild Cochran, who is the daughter of Louise Morley, the eldest daughter of Christopher Morley.
Morley died after a long illness in 1957 when Janet and Jock were still quite young. Their memories, as you might expect, were more about a grandfather than a writer or a Sherlockian.
He was Grandpa, and she was Gara, because my older brother couldn't pronounce grandmother or grandma. And they were just these gentle people that just thrilled upon the energy of children. I'm told afterwards that they were also very glad when the energy of the children calmed down and went home.
I had a different experience because my sister and I grew up in Britain, and we came and spent 6 months in Roslyn in 1955. So we had an in-depth experience of 6 months of living at Green Escape, which was wonderful. But unfortunately, by that time, Grandpa had had a stroke. So my main memories of him are when he and Grandma came and stayed with us in London, and they were always very jolly grandparents, as grandparents always are. I think there was a time, though, when my mother was at Bryn Mawr and Kitty Foyle was published. And Kitty Foyle at the time was very controversial because it was seen as very avant-garde, particularly for a man to write a novel in first person of a woman. And she was very embarrassed, thinking, because people thought that she and her sisters had given all this information to Christopher Morley to write Kitty Foyle. Not a bit of it. He'd just done it through his own research and experience of talking to grown women, not teenage daughters. But I think at that time, my mother was very embarrassed to be the daughter of the famous author Christopher Morley.
Earlier in the day, Jock Woodruff gave some thoughtful remarks and shared some family pictures he had brought with him from California.
I do a lot of public speaking, and I often start out saying, I come from a family of storytellers. And people just, And it's usually at the beginning of a 5-day training where I'm training people and doing a lot of, and all through the training, I invariably say, it's okay if I share a little story. And I realized that that is something that truly has come to me, and it's been passed down. And I believe, as Janet referenced, it's all about being in community. And I know that this is something that a lot of people, from time to time, I worry that perhaps this ability to share that spoken legend, that ability to share, to come into and to be able to be shoulder to shoulder and to allow for disparate beliefs and ideas to have so much room to flourish. I always worry that that may not be able to happen and continue.
But a genuine surprise at this event was the appearance of a special guest.
My name is Allegra Fuller Snyder, and I am Buckminster Fuller's daughter. And Chris and Bucky were very, very dear friends, and certainly Chris was a very important friend to Bucky and really opened a lot of doors of his mind as well as actions.
Now, who is or who was Buckminster Fuller, some of you might ask. Fuller was born in 1895 and for the last 9 years of his life was president of Mensa, the largest and oldest IQ society in the world. His work as a thinker and engineer made an impression on me when I was younger. Today, he has been somewhat forgotten. But for a quick introduction, we can turn to Larry King, who had this to say when he interviewed Fuller in 1983. Fuller died later that year.
Buckminster Fuller is the best-known American thinker alive. He is called the planet's friendly genius. He has gained renown as an inventor and designer of the Demoxian house, the Demoxian cat, the Demoxian map, the creator of the, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Gettyscope Dome, the man who coined the term Spaceship Earth, organized the world game, a mathematician who discovered synergetics, and as a dogged individualist whose genius has been felt throughout the world, we welcome to our microphones Buckminster Fuller. How do you keep going?
I'm sure the reason I'm able to keep going is that people seem to care about what I'm doing. And because I've discovered that humanity really has an option to make it on this planet. Within a 10-year design revolution, we could have all humanity living at the highest standard of living anybody's ever known on a sustainable basis, while phasing out all further use of fossil fuels and atomic energy. All this can be done through technology, employing the ever-advancing capability to do more for each pound of material, each erg of energy, and each second of time invested.
Buckminster Fuller's daughter, Allegra, had this perspective about her father.
What's interesting is that I suspect actually more of your listeners will be aware of him today than they were 20 years ago. I think that he was trying to address what one individual can do with the suggestion that we all had that individual power in us to make changes in our planet Earth that would really be critical to us. And now we're unfortunately faced with these very things that he was aware were coming. And now we all begin to realize that we really do have to do something. And maybe some of his own insights, which were really clearly to, I mentioned a little bit in my own talk, his emphasis on direct experience, that really direct experience was the most critical element in learning and the process of teaching oneself. Yeah.
I asked Allegra what it was like to grow up as the daughter of a self-described comprehensive, anticipatory design scientist.
Really, at the time that I sort of was a early teenager, very aware of things, he was mostly considered, Bucky Rogers in the 21st century, but this is a pretty crazy man that's got these crazy ideas. Not a lot of respect initially, and things have changed today. Things have very much changed, yeah.
But what, you may ask, was the connection between this polymath and Christopher Morley, the founder of the Baker Street Irregulars?
They were in correspondence before they actually met, and this would have been around 1929, 1930. And Bucky was beginning to get a grip on what he was going to do and how he was going to do it, but his beginning correspondence with Chris and then his actual coming to know him really gave him, it wasn't just courage and insights, but it was a real seeing another person really clearly thinking in a very deep I was about to say poetic, and then I thought that's going to confuse everybody, but it was a imaging and taking a position on or a grip of your experience. So imagination is not something that floats off in the side. It's absolutely fundamental. Yeah.
Morley and Fuller connected early on through their mutual love of the boundless imagination of childhood.
Chris had a most extraordinary love and understanding of children. And my father was very, very deeply affected by that. And it was early on that my father was prompted to write to Chris because he had just lost his first child. He felt that Chris's insights into the child and what the child, the power of the child was very, very important to him. I'm spending a lot of time now talking about my father and his real emphasis on the source of his understanding is direct experience. And he felt the child had that innate sensitivity. That the first thing I want to do is to experience things. And it's only later that they're pushed to be articulate about it. But it's the deep experience first.
Morley and Fuller had a deep friendship and extensive correspondence for almost 30 years. That friendship was documented by Christopher Morley's eldest daughter, Louise Morley Cochran, who was the mother of Janet Sidaway. Louise wrote a book about their friendship and correspondence, which she called The Sense of Significance. It was not published in her lifetime, but Janet Sidaway told us about the book in her remarks.
In a few minutes, you're going to be given a book, and it gives me great pleasure to give this to you on behalf of my father, Peter, my sister, Alison. The book is about the friendship between Christopher Morley and Buckminster Fuller. It was written by my mother, Louise, who died in 2012, and who was never able to get it published. But it was written with the active encouragement of Bucky himself. And I'm happy to say that thanks to the active encouragement and help of Allegra, sitting here, my family decided to publish it. We felt the book was important to get out into wider circulation, because it reflected something of deep importance to both of the men. Their friendship was important to them, and it chronicles the steps in that friendship and up until the death of Grandpa, as I called him, in 1957. But I think the book is important in another way, It highlights something for which Grandpa had a great gift, to which Steve has already referred. And that was his gift of friendship and his gift of empathy. And he liked nothing more than meeting people and finding they were kindred spirits and then becoming a kinspirit with them, as he said. And my father became an instant kinspirit when he met his future father-in-law. Some of you might not know that my parents met and fell in love in the early 1940s. My father was sent by the British Army as a representative to come over and talk about the war in Europe as part of a program of introduction of information to, particularly to US college students, about what was happening in the war. My parents met, fell in love. Peter was taken to be introduced to the family at Green Escape up the road, fell in love with the family, fell in love with Louise's father, as much as he fell in love with Louise herself, I think. So the upshot of that was in 1943, Louise came to Blitz in London, waited for Peter to come on leave. They got married September 1943. Yeah. Then Peter went off for 2.5 years, sent by the army hither and thither. But he ended up in Quetta, which is now in Pakistan. And I thought you might be interested in something from his also unpublished memoirs. He was sent for his last posting in the end of 45, beginning of 46, to Quetta, to the Staff College. So here he is, March 1946. March at last brought spring, with the beginning of the almond blossom and wildflowers, which transformed Quetta from an arid dump into a still shabby little town set in a sea of flowering trees and greensward. It also brought a three-day half-term break and my first attack of malaria, so sudden that Dick Finch bundled me into a taxi and delivered me to the hospital. When I came round after the initial fever, I thought I must still be hallucinating, for I could hear the distinctive voice of Louise's father, the OM, or the old man, as all the family called him. It turned out to be a transatlantic quiz on the ward radio. So I think the story is interesting in two aspects. One, he did have a very distinctive voice. And two, that voice was very far-reaching. And I think as I look around today and I see what Terry and Linda have accomplished bringing you all here, I think that voice is still far-reaching and it is creating friends. And I'm just very pleased to be with some kinspirits. Thank you very much to Terry and Linda.
The book has now been published to commemorate Morley's 125th birthday. Terry and Linda Hunt are handling sales of the book in America. Proceeds will benefit the Knothole Association, which maintains the cabin at Christopher Morley Park, set on 98 acres and centrally located in Nassau County. And here is how Morley described it. "I built myself a pinewood cabin, as aloofly as a Long Island suburb would permit, to consort with the shade of John Bartlett." If you would like a copy of the book, send an email to Terry and Linda at Hoboken Free State, all one word, at mhcable.com, and they will tell you the details. During his lifetime, Christopher Morley founded the Baker Street Irregulars, wrote more than 50 books, including popular novels, plays, poetry, and essays. He edited 2 volumes of Bartlett's familiar quotations and was a founder of the Book of the Month Club. So it was not surprising that Jock Woodruff and Janet Sitaway remarked upon books and writers as the day drew to a close.
I'm glad. I'm a firm believer that when there is this connection amongst people and amongst writers and connections with their works, that there's always going to be the opportunity for others to connect and to gain their own meaning and have their own understandings around the work. And I think the thing that is really lovely to see today is all of the interconnections of other authors, of other writers, of other journalists, of other poets, of of incredible thinkers such as Buckminster Fuller, and I think that that's the thing that just continues to live on. That gives me an extreme hope of moving forward into the future for all generations.
But I can't resist saying that a lot of the reason that his name lives on is through Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle. And I think a lot of people are introduced to Morley's work and to the wider world of his connections through Sherlock Holmes. And long may that continue.
Yeah.
Chris Morley never lost his delight in meeting kin spirits, especially readers who explored and enjoyed his work. Stephen Rothman reminded me of that when he noticed a letter of Morley's on display at the Roslyn Library.
This is a letter. Being only human, I could not resist looking at your comments on the margins of pipefuls, so someone must have sent him a copy to sign. And I'm honestly touched that you should have enjoyed the book so much. I don't know anything that could give a writer more genuine and innocent happiness than to see one of his books wearing such candid and understanding badges of attention. I wonder what your friends will think of it. Sincerely yours, Christopher Morley. Am returning the book by mail.
This was a great day to celebrate writers and writing and the 125th birthday of one of the best.
Doesn't get much better than Christopher Morley, does it?
No, it was a wonderful, as you can get the sense, it was a wonderful day and a great effort. And it's lovely to look back on the birthdays of the people that we admire. And by the way, we should mention that on the day we're recording this, June 13th, today happens to be the birthday of two greats. 1893, today was the birthday of Dorothy L. Sayers. And just a short year before, 1892, Philip St. John Basil Rathbone was born.
Philip St. John.
Yeah, that's my memory. That's his full. That's his, as George Burns would say, that's his right name, Philip St. John Basil Rathbone.
I've never singed my inn before. It sounds painful.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great day. It's a great day overall.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, we have Christopher Morley to thank for what we continue to celebrate. To this day, the companionship of other Sherlockians in an organized fashion.
And I have to say, you know, we mentioned there in that segment about the book that Janet Sitaway and her sister Allison have now made possible, The Sense of Significance, which is a terrific book. And we told you in that little clip how you can find out more information about it. The proceeds go to benefit the Knothole. But it is absolutely fascinating. You'll learn in there. It's really a great documentary history of the friendship between Morley and Buckminster Fuller. And you'll learn in there about Morley's interest with Fuller in numerology, which I never suspected. You will find some ruminations about Morley focused on mortality and math. It turns out one of the great intersections he had with Fuller was an interest in mathematics. Of course, his father was a mathematics professor, but his father never published anything about the dynamics of an asteroid. And the BSI prayer and Buckminster Fuller and Vincent Starrett and all kinds of interesting stuff here. In fact, there's a letter that Morley sends to Fuller in July of 1944, and in the middle of it he says, "I've just got from a secondhand bookseller in Newton Center, Massachusetts, a cheap copy of The Martyrdom of Man, the wonderful book so highly praised by Sherlock Holmes. I had a copy years ago, but it got away from me somehow. Then I found one, which I gave to Edgar Smith, and now, by God, I have one for myself again. The title is grimly appropriate to these days." Of course, when he published the book in 1872, his denial of anthropomorphic God and his insistence that immortality was only a charming illusion were pretty sour doctrine to most of his readers. But one can still admire the excellent words of his preface and adapt them to whatever personal heresies are needed today. It's just, the whole thing is just absolutely fascinating.
That is great.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation.
Welcome to the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere quiz program called Mental Exaltation. If you've ever listened to NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or Weekend Edition Sunday with Puzzle Master Will Shortz, you'll be familiar with our format. But just in case you haven't listened to those, here's how it works. Each episode, we'll post a qualifying question on our website on iheroSherlock.com. And of all the correct answers submitted, we will select one individual at random to become a contestant on Mental Exaltation. The format varies from show to show. Sometimes we have our guests standing in as proxies for the contestants, and other times we have the contestants themselves calling in to the show. And in this case, we actually have one of those very fortunate contestants. We are pleased to welcome Sandy Kozin of Demarest, New Jersey. Hi, Sandy.
And I am pleased to be there.
Excellent. Well, you're a long time Sherlockian, isn't that right?
Fairly a long time. I guess I really got involved in the mid-80s.
Mid-80s, okay.
I was, or maybe a little bit before then.
Okay. So is that... Would that be the Epilogues or Mrs. Hudson's Cliff Dwellers? Where's your home scion?
Well, Mrs. Hudson's Cliff Dwellers is my home scion, but I really got involved. I had read the stories, of course, before, and I have a cherished copy that my father had given me. I was personal friends for another reason to Tom Six, who was, by way of being a near neighbor, next town up.
Excellent.
Or two of mine. And we just knew one another from other places.
Mm-hmm.
And he would occasionally hold a Mrs. Hudson's meeting at his house. He insisted that I come. So I came, and I liked it.
That's wonderful.
It was fun. They were nice people.
Yes, they are. They still are to this day. And if I recall correctly, you were one of the earlier members, along with me, of the Hounds of the Internet.
That's right, yes. I've been involved for a long time on the Hounds. I joined that also in the early 80s. I wasn't one of the founding members. but I've been on since Steve Clarkson's day, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Good times.
Those were good times, yeah. Yes. And he was a great Sherlockian.
He was, and we miss him dearly.
We certainly do. We do. He's a good friend to a lot of people.
Indeed.
To a lot of Sherlockians. And a good mentor to a lot of Sherlockians.
A lot of young Sherlockians, right. Yeah. I think the 2003 Baker Street Journal Christmas Annual was about the young Sherlockian movement. And I know Steve and some of his activities were highlighted in that as well.
Yes, he did a good job, and he knew a lot of stuff. He really knew a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember sitting in the Algonquin with him late one night, over a beverage or two, and there were a few of us there, and we were playing this game where you could hold a conversation about anything, but everything you said had to be a Sherlockian quote.
Oh my goodness! Wow. Talk about a challenge, huh?
Well, it was fun. It was fun. I was younger and had a better memory.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's hope your memory serves you well on our little program here. Now, just for refreshers, you qualified to come on the show by answering this question on the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere website. The question was, who was the most litigious individual in the Sherlock Holmes stories? Do you remember who you said?
Yeah, that would be Franklin and Mr. Franklin in The Hound.
That is correct. Frank the Crank, as I like to call him.
Yeah, and he was Laura Lyon's father, if I remember correctly.
Spoiler alert.
Oops. Sorry.
I think most of our listeners know The Hound pretty well at this point. So that was great. So, of course, the The theme therein was inspired by a topic that we've just discussed at length on the show here, which is the law, and in particular lawsuits. So because we've done that, we're going to ask you three questions about representatives of the law throughout the canon. Get two of them right, and you'll win our prize. Are you ready?
I'll do my best.
All right.
Shall the examination proceed? Yes, let it proceed by all means.
First up, barristers. In The Illustrious Client, what is said about the barrister who crams up a case with such care that he can examine an expert witness upon the Monday? A. Such excessive preparation invariably means mistakes upon execution. B. He has forgotten all his forced knowledge before the Saturday. Or C. No one wants to sit with him at dinner because he only talks about matters of chronology.
I don't recall the quote, but I'm going to take a stab at B.
At B?
At B.
That is correct. That is correct. So that's one. Now, next, a question about solicitors. In all the recorded cases, Holmes is employed by only one solicitor. Who is it? A. Alexander Holder in The Beryl Coronet. B. Josiah Amberley in The Retired Colorman. Or C. John Hector McFarlane in The Norwood Builder.
That's an easy one. That's C. That's McFarlane.
That is correct. That's two. So you've already qualified for our prize. So we're going to go for broke here. See if you can get three out of three and just make it a clean sweep. The third question brings our terminology across the pond as we're finally asking you about lawyers. In The Sussex Vampire, what is the specialty of the law firm of Morrison, Morrison, and Dodd? A. Elaborate schemes to distract gullible shop owners. B. The assessment of machinery. Or C. Defending itself against the Conan Doyle Estate Limited.
That's B, although they probably would make more money with C. It was B.
That is correct. That is correct. Well, congratulations. You've done a phenomenal job here on the show for three out of three.
Well, thank you for the multiple choices. They're a lot easier for me. My recall is better than my memory, if you know what I mean.
I do. I understand entirely. Well, we have Nick Martorelli, our resident quiz master, to thank for that format and those excellent questions.
Well, and thank you, Nick.
All right. Well, Sandy, thanks for being with us today, and we will follow up with your excellent prize.
Thank you. The grab, anything from the grab bag is fine.
The IHOS GBG.
Right.
Excellent.
I love surprises.
Well, we'll be sure to surprise you.
Thank you very much.
That's great.
And good night.
All right, Sandy, you take care. Have a good evening. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm getting that sense again. That's the very one. How did you know?
We always reach for the Tums around this time
of day. We do. Well, this gas lamp has been some time in planning. We were at the Baker Street Irregulars dinner in January, where, by the way, Bert, you gave a lovely singing toast to Mrs. Hudson. Mrs.
Hudson, Starrett named you.
Yeah. And speaking of Starrett, Ray Betzner, who, of course, joined us on, I think it was episode 61 with Susan Rice, to talk about Vincent Starrett. and who writes Studies in Sterrett, a Vincent Sterrett-inspired blog. Ray got up to the podium and gave a really, what I can only describe as emotion-filled remembrance of Sherlock Holmes in the guise of Sigerson during the Great Hiatus. And we asked Ray if he would, well, if we could use that for one of our gas lamps, because it was that touching. But the caveat was Ray had to read it because it was in the delivery, I think, that it commanded the level of emotion and attention that it deserved. And Ray was kind enough to record himself giving that very same paper, or toast, or however you think about it, at a recent Sons of the Copper Beeches meeting.
Yeah, the very day we were at
I think you're right. I think it was in late April.
Oh, all right. So it was the same day we were at the band.
We were in Boston.
Beeches met. Yeah.
And that very night, Ray was in back of the podium in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And the title of his paper was A Case of Identity, Sigerson's Choice.
Sherlock Holmes died at the Reichenbach Falls. Moriarty tried to kill him, but failed. It was the Baker Street detective himself who put an end to the existence of Sherlock Holmes and created the identity of Sigerson. And so it was Sigerson, not Holmes, who climbed the almost sheer cliff above the falls. Sigerson, who raced away from Colonel Sebastian Moran, and Sigerson, who roamed from Tibet to Lhasa, from Khartoum to the south of France. For too long, canonical scholars have treated Sigerson as another one of Holmes's disguises, a kind of three-year-long piece of performance art. In fact, Sigerson was a fully formed individual whose life was perfectly designed for the man who had once been Sherlock Holmes. Sigerson could go everywhere, see everything, overhear everyone. Sigerson never endured the endless days of boredom sitting around waiting for a challenge worthy of his talents. Every day was a new opportunity to seek out adventures, to solve mysteries, or to travel the world without a care or a calendar. And if he yearned for urban crime solving, he was no longer restricted to London, Chicago, or Budapest. Istanbul or Paris were all open to Sigerson. The only real mystery then is this. Why did he give it up after only 3 years? Why did Sigerson disappear and Sherlock Holmes return to London to reestablish his consulting practice? The canonical explanation is that Holmes returned to London to oversee the capture of Colonel Sebastian Moran. But this makes no sense whatsoever. Moran was a world-traveling hunter, searching for game in the highest Himalayas or the deepest jungle. If Sigerson had wanted Moran out of the way, he could have easily arranged for a slip from the mountain pass or a malfunctioning rifle. No, Moran was not enough. There must have been a greater reason for Sigerson to give up his perfect life. The answer, I suggest, lies back in London with Dr. Watson. We know almost nothing about Watson's life during the Great Hiatus. Surely, using Holmes's methods, we can piece together a picture of how Watson coped over that time. I must warn you, gentlemen, we are entering deep waters. Let's start with the tragic events of the Reichenbach. Watson was devastated by the death of Sherlock Holmes. He lost his closest friend, his hero, the best and the wisest. He also lost a bit of himself. Without Sherlock Holmes, Watson was no longer the faithful companion, the Boswell, the conductor of light. But even in his anguish, Watson could take solace that he was not alone. After a day of rounds, he could still come home to a warm, bright parlor because he had his beloved Mary. With Mary, he was a husband and a lover. Maybe someday soon he could be a father. Watson's life still had joy and purpose because he still had Mary. Oh, Mary. If the death of Sherlock Holmes left Watson despondent, Mary's death left him speechless. Years later, when he couldn't avoid making some acknowledgement of her passing, Watson could only refer to her death in the most oblique manner. He never again used her name. Watson never again wrote the name Mary. Now, instead of a warm home, he came home to a cold, dark, and empty house. His only solace was a tin box of notes and diaries, the reminder of everything that he had lost, everything that he had loved, now all gone, now all dead. With each passing day, Watson sank a little bit deeper into that great cesspool of despair. How did he cope? His brother, Henry, had been an alcoholic. Sherlock Holmes had used morphine and cocaine to deal with his own mental anguish. Whatever course he chose, John Watson was not the first doctor to self-medicate away his pain. Of course, there were costs. It is a pathological and morbid process which involves increased tissue change and may at least leave a permanent weakness. As time went on, the influence of this treatment plan grew until Watson became so frail, so fragile, that the least shock could leave him in a dead faint. It must have been Mycroft. Only Mycroft had the resources to fully understand Watson's condition. And only Mycroft would know how to get a letter to Severson. What would you do? Would you give up a perfect life, a persona that met your every need, and return to an identity that brought you this close to death? And would you do it all for the sake of one old friend? For Severson, that choice meant no more trips to spy on the Khalifa, no more long talks discussing the meaning of death and life with the head lama. And writing The Whole Art of Detection? Well, that would have to wait until retirement if he lived that long. In the end, friendship prevailed. Severson disappeared just as quickly as he had been created, so that Sherlock Holmes could return to London and save the life of John Watson. Bringing Watson back to Baker Street and into the adventure-filled life he once knew provided the good doctor with the excitement and purpose that he needed in his life. His hero had returned. Watson was once again Holmes's Boswell, the good doctor, my dear Watson. Now that his life had meaning, Watson no longer needed to self-medicate. After all, work is the best antidote to, well, sorrow. And if of an evening Watson's melancholy ever became too great, Sherlock Holmes could remind him of a lesson Sigerson had learned during the great hiatus, a lesson that, in its own way, applied to both Holmes and Watson. Your life is not your own. Thank you very much.
Wow. See what I told you? that wouldn't have done simply being read by you or I.
Oh, no. Ray does it very well.
Yeah.
Well, and it shows you, you know, if you folks, if any of our listeners have been thinking about writing Sherlockian papers and so on, it's just another example of what's possible in this fascinating area of interest of ours.
Indeed it does. Well, here, we have done it again. And, you know, if you folks have any commentary, any other tips or criticism or witticism, we would love to hear from you.
Oh, wait a minute. When are we going to put in the comments?
Good point.
Yeah, and you got to leave room for the quiz, too.
I do, yeah.
Well, I guess that can be before the gas lamp.
We'll do the quiz before the gas lamp. Why don't we do the listener comments after the gas lamp? So we had a commentary about the gas lamp, and well, you know, we love to hear from you. And during the last episode, we asked if you would send us some audio comments, and we did say that we would reward one of them with a copy of the John H. Watson Society's latest monograph from James O'Leary, Some Observations on the Early Writing of John Watson, M.D., 1887 to 1894.
Mm-hmm.
So we did get some comments in. Some were related to it, some were not. But we thought we would play those for you because we had what did we challenge people to do? We asked them
what they admired about Dr. Watson.
I was going to say their favorite feature about Burt Walter, but I think that's I think that's right. That sounds right. Yeah. Cuz that fits in with the monograph title, doesn't it?
The hawk-faced visage.
Their favorite feature of Dr. Watson. And as you can imagine, it ran the gamut, but let's hear what some of our listeners had to say.
Hi, Bert and Scott. It's Mary Miller from Indianapolis. You're asking what I admire most about John H. Watson, M.D., and it is his loyalty to Sherlock, especially when Sherlock is at his lowest point. That is a sign of a true friend. Thanks for all that you do for I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. I enjoy the podcast and keep up the great work. Thanks.
Yeah, nice.
Oh, that's great. And we're always at our lowest point, Mary, so we appreciate that. We appreciate that. Okay, and here's another one.
Hi, everybody. I'm terribly sorry for my disgusting accent, so I'll try to get straight to the point. There are indeed a lot of things to admire about Watson, that he's a faithful friend and so on. Yet, the most amazing thing about this character is his impressive ability to wonder. Actually, the story begins with Watson's sincere astonishment. How on earth did you know that? The great detective was quite pleased with such a reaction. Watson hasn't lost that ability even after all these adventures. Furthermore, he shared this ability with his readers. He told them, just look, this consulting detective is really amazing. It's not a matter of fact thing. It's a miracle, a sort of. For me, this is the most admirable thing about the character.
Well, that's great. That was from Tatiana Dibina.
Yes, and Tatiana, you should not apologize for your accent at all. Your English is fabulous.
It is indeed. And the point is well taken. You know, Watson's ability to wonder at Holmes's abilities and the way that he brings that along to his readers, I think it's a great gift. Mm. And it is one that I think that continues to help us admire the talents of one Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
Hi, guys. It's John Guillen from Queensville, Ontario, Canada. I'm calling in desperately trying to win what should be that wonderful book about the early writings of John Watson.
You've done it, John.
It's amazing. John, you have the will, but not the content. I'll tell you what. John is a longtime listener, we know. We have an extra copy, John. So if you want to call us back and make good on the rest of your message, we would love
to hear
it. Oh,
really? Is that all that came through?
That's all that came through.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm dying to know what he thinks.
Yeah, me too.
But that's one possible. Now, here's a comment that really doesn't have anything to do with the contest, but I think is worth playing anyway because it's well, you'll hear who it's from.
This is Dr. Watson speaking to you from Baker Street and wishing to extend the appreciation of myself and Sherlock Holmes in finding us both some additional stories to offer our many listeners throughout the culture-barren universe. The great detective is with me here and wishes to offer a few words to you both. Thanks to Mr. Monte and Mr. Walder for the wonderful efforts you have pursued in re-establishing my eternal presence in the world. Thank you, gentlemen. Keep up the good work.
Wow. I had no idea they were listeners.
That's wonderful.
Isn't that great?
And it's, you know, it's all due to Petri wine, I think.
It must be.
It's wonderful.
It must be. No, that is from none other than David Ian Davies.
The genius of David Ian Davies.
Indeed. You may remember him from, I believe it was episode 40, One Voice of Sherlock Holmes. Take a listen to our interview with David and his wonderful vocal talents in doing all the characters in the canon. We really appreciate that that audio message, David.
That's fabulous.
Isn't it?
I think I'll play that every day when I wake up.
It's my new ringtone.
Yes.
Well, folks, if you would like to do the same, if you would love to leave us an audio comment like that, you can either attach it as an audio file to an email, if you want to email us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com, or give a call to our call-in line at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323.
Yes, indeed.
And don't forget, we would love to have a review from you if you can handle it on iTunes, either online or on your phone. Just check it out at bit.ly/iHearOfSherlock.
Yes, but please, folks, wait until episode 79 before going back to the carrier pigeons because it's cage cleanout time at I Hear of Sherlock, and we have some work to do.
Well, we need to collect all of that newsprint from the Free Mr. Holmes lawsuit that we can then line the cages with. That will be happening.
I think we'd upset the birds if we did that.
Well, what are they going to do? Crap on the ceiling? I mean, come on. Something. But this is the part where we wrap up the show and thank you profusely once again for being with us.
Yes.
And we look forward to next time as I say, this is Scott Monty.
Yes, that is Scott Monty, and I'm Bert Wolder, and together we admit that
the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, my God, we did it.